This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
Dr. Lauren Rosewarne is a senior lecturer in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. She currently teaches in the areas of public policy and gender studies. Lauren has numerous qualifications, including a PhD in political science. Lauren's authored 6 books, including her most recent last year, Masturbation and Pop Culture, Screen, Society and Self. Lauren's here tonight to chat with us about feminism and equality, which are always important topics for discussion, but particularly this week in the lead up to International Women's Day. Lauren, welcome to Lefty Pinkos.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you haven't done Lefty Pinkos.
I haven't. I've done a number of things at Joy. I've done Dean's Hide and Seek, or Hide and Seek with Dean and his Word for Word. But no, I've never done Lefty Pinkos. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, you're most welcome. One thing I thought I'd start with, just a good opening question, and that is, why do you think feminism is still a dirty word that so many women feel the need to distance themselves from?
Yeah, and this is, I try and tackle this with my students, because I get students who come and study gender studies with a thought that maybe they're interested in sexuality, but they still feel some sort of distance from the F word. And I warn them, or I sort of reassure them that there's not going to be a baptism in my classes. I don't really, there's not going to be any sense of I'm going to try and convert you. That said, I always answer it with the fact that I don't think anyone I spend time with are opposed to equality. So therefore, I don't know any people or spend time with people who aren't feminist. I think most people who have a social conscience are also pro-equality. They nevertheless still find a distance with that F word. Mm. And I think of my own parents and my grandparents, who they all had equality as something that they believed in, be it social equality, labour market, etc., etc., but yet they didn't use the word. And I think that's partly attributable to the fact that in the 70s and the 80s, feminism became associated with sort of an activism that not everyone subscribes to. So this idea of bra burning, for example, or the idea of abandoning femininity, or the concept of what's often called doctrinaire feminism, which is really just about the idea that there's a set agenda that you have to follow if you're going to be a feminist. Now, most feminists today wouldn't say that they know what's right for you. I certainly don't. But because there are so many issues, for example, the radical feminists who were strongly opposed to sex work and still continue to be opposed to sex work. For those of us who actually are pro, you know, safe and consensual sex work, that branch of feminism seems quite distancing. Mm. But nonetheless, I think, A, it's had a bad reputation in the media, and that's partly because the media have been hostile to doing things differently. So therefore, it's no surprise that the people who have been so sexist for so long advance a negative reputation or a negative branding of feminists to further their own agenda. And I think the other aspect is as well, is issues such as sex work have created divisions where people feel that that label doesn't cover their interests.
It's almost like people have stuck a static understanding of feminism to the people in various feminist groups, and that label, that static label, has been attached to the word feminism when there is no right answer.
Absolutely, and I think you hit the nail on the head about that idea of it's considered often an anachronism or something that described things that were happening in the 70s, and it doesn't describe women today and the activism and the kind of things that they're interested in today. Now, whether or not that feminism now needs a rebranding, or whether in fact other words have come to help fill that gap and describe niche issues that potentially don't unite us all but cover certain topics that each of us are interested in, perhaps that's the case. I don't have an answer. It's a word that's valuable to me, but I also get the reluctance for other people to rally under it, particularly given that there's so little we all agree on.
So that's where you start with your students. You try and get over that hurt, that the F word
Yeah, problem. Absolutely. I go in with the premise that I actually think most of the people who would be attracted to studying gender studies would believe in equality. Mm. And that's my starting point, that you're all actually on the same side. And whether this word's applicable or not to you, you can think about across the whole semester, if not your entire lifetime, really. But I like to look at the issues that still are important for what I consider feminist activism, and whether or not you then continue to champion those issues under other banners, you know, be it queer theory or whatever it is. The issues are what's important, let alone, or, you know, regardless of whether you care about the label.
So what are your hot issues?
At the moment, I'm looking at international gender politics with my students. So this is the thing, such as we take it for granted, you know, every International Women's Day, I'll be called in on a mainstream radio or newspaper for an interview about why do we still need to have these stupid days? You know, why everything's so wonderful? We're in this magical fairyland. Why are we still having an International Women's Day? And I have to every single time say the same thing. While we still have statistics that show women are more likely to be the, you know, victims of domestic violence, rape, pay disparity, et cetera, and that's just in Australia, let alone the issues that are facing women around the world, you know, and things such as the continued contestation around cultural practices such as female genital mutilation, for example, which are increasing in some areas around the world as a sort of backlash against the Western values, things such as veiling. Do we consider, for example, veiling to be this ultimate sign of oppression? The rise of fundamentalist religions that tend to subordinate women quite consistently. Mm. These are issues that remain topical, and we don't have it perfect in Australia, let alone our sisters, if you like, in the rest of the world. So the idea of having an International Women's Day, of course we still need that. Mm.
And I think when we talk about women and feminism in Australia, I think at a broad level, for a lot of people, what people are picturing in their minds is white, probably middle-class, heterosexual, cisgender women. And that's not the case in Australia. It's not the case across the world. And I think there's still that misconception for people that that's all that feminism is about and that's who it's for.
And even in even as early as the 80s, issue was flagged that, hang on, African-American women, where, you know, a lot of the first feminist work came out of the United States and the UK, African-American women were saying, hang on a sec, I don't feel myself included in this very white, very academic movement as well, let alone people who don't identify as heterosexual or feminine in the way that's being construed by the movement, etc. So I think absolutely, feminism has done, has been slow to take up the issues of women who are further marginalised for issues that are not just gender. That said, I think it also, you're seeing great work come from women of colour, women around the world as well. So I think that's a problem that's becoming less of a problem, except there's also now issues of can white academic heterosexual women speak on behalf of women who, for example, choose to wear veils or who have been victims of female genital mutilation. Is there a conflict there? And this is where we talk about that sort of cultural relativism. Can you talk about a culture that you're not part of? And that's one of those debates that feminists still have, or not just feminists, though, in fact, any people continue to have, as to can you speak on behalf of or for communities that you're not for, you know, and that happens in Indigenous communities in Australia. Can white people talk about their issues on their behalf? Is there a conflict there?
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
There was controversy, I think it was only last week, there was a lot of, in the mainstream media, there was a lot of support around what Patricia Arquette had to say about equality for women. Now, I know that you wrote an article about this, and you did it from the perspective, I think, of ageing, and you're getting these comments from someone in the Hollywood industry who set these unrealistic standards for everybody. But there was also a lot of the media that I read, there was a lot of backlash for that same issue, that really, like, her words, which probably weren't intentional, really grouped people in terms of you know, race. She referred to you know, people of color and gay people separate from women, as if women just are white women.
Yeah, and that's a really tricky thing. On one hand, I'm not entirely sure that It's tricky because I think she probably did know that her speech would have that kind of impact. You don't give an awards speech to the Academy Awards and not think that anyone's going to listen to it. So on one hand, I think that, yes, that she used her platform for good, that in principle saying something rather than thanking God is probably a step in the right direction. That said, I think, yeah, you're right. That idea of dividing up people and still considering, that women still need to be advanced separate from a whole lot of other traditionally marginalised group, that is a problem. That said, it's probably not surprising that given who she is and her position in Hollywood, as an established star, if you like, that these are I don't think there was a malicious intent. It's probably I like to give people the benefit of the doubt with language because, again, language can be quite emotive for people who are on the receiving end and feeling excluded from when someone speaks. Like Patricia Arquette, that people who were gay, for example, felt that they weren't being included in her cry for equality. I don't think she was deliberately trying to be exclusionary. I think it was simply laziness in speech that it's not deliberate but is a generational thing that we're going to take time to get everyone on board. And no one's perfect. We all slip as well with language as well.
And do you think it's a problem that the message for some people is then lost because we're so quick to jump on those unintentional things, which we all do?
And this is the problem with social media as well, is that initially the story was reported as a good news story. Within 3 hours, it was then condemned as this further dividing communities. And I think that's, again, the power, but also the peril of social media as well, where we're all looking for angles. I was asked by the ABC to write something on it. So I have to also, that's part of my job, is to look, well, how do I want to critique this? Now, that doesn't mean condemning her, but it means asking questions of that situation. And I think, I don't know, I like the fact that we talk about stuff as a culture, and I think that's one of the benefits of social media, but there is a danger in that the good of stuff is often lost in the overthinking. And that's the same as the proverb, if you ask yourself whether you're happy, you cease to be. So the second you start thinking about your own happiness, your own joy, you start to feel it less and less and less. And I think that's the same with a good message. The second we start questioning, is it good enough, some of the power is lost.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
It is International Women's Day on Sunday. And Lauren, the theme this year is make it happen. Probably a little bit of a cliche to ask you this, but I want to know what it means to you and why it hasn't already happened.
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? I think make it happen firstly is, and I hadn't put much thought into it until you just asked, but I think that's probably a response to the fact that this generation, and I'm thinking Generation Y and millennials, are often criticised for being slacktivists, that they're no longer going out on the streets and protesting for issues, that they're clicking likes on Facebook pages or forwarding Kony videos and feeling that that's enough for political activism. So that idea of make it happen is probably a response to be more active. Now, I think that criticism of the social mediaization of activism is a little bit harsh because we're all so tech savvy now that, of course, that's going to be our default tool for activism. But that idea that, in fact, tangible change has to happen, that it's not enough to just put up a video or click some news items that we like, but actually some concrete changes need to be made, that's more important. And again, Australia is quite good in the sense that there is a lot of legislation already in place that makes it happen in terms of that journey towards equality, but that there is still stuff left to do.
In terms of our legislation and our leaders, for young people, do they have people to look up to?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question about the concept of leadership, because for the past 3 or 4 elections, I've actually voted nothing in the sense I've put in blank ballots, because for me, there haven't been candidates that I felt represent my issues or my interests. Now, I say that as a political scientist who's really passionate about compulsory voting, and yet I've put in blank ballots. So that, I'm deliberately going to the polls. I think that it is important that I show up, but it's also important that I show up and show my contempt. And that's partly, I think, to do with the fact that I think you've seen seen both parties sort of merge and try and fight for the same terrain. So they tend to, for example, agree on a whole lot of stuff because they're trying to court the same audience. And that's then meaning that there's no longer distinctions between the parties in the way that there once were. For example, you know, if you had a family who were left inclined, caring about workers' rights, et cetera, et cetera, the Labor Party was quite the default party that they voted for. And I certainly came from that family myself. But, you know, I had a time where when I finished high school, I went to work for the Labor Party. That feels like a very long time ago for me now because I don't see myself reflected in the contemporary party. Now, is that because they've become a more right-wing party? Is it because their radicalness has started to fade because they're trying to be more conservative and distance themselves away from the unions? There's lots of different reasons, but I think we definitely, like in every area of life, be it the media, children's toys — I did an interview on children's toys over the weekend — popular culture, etc., diversity is really important. Mm. So seeing leaders that reflect that we're all a cosmopolitan, you know, country, sure, but that we're also made up of a whole lot of different types of people. Yeah. And rather than seeing a dominance of white men coming from wealthy backgrounds, which is the case in most Western countries where their politicians look roughly the same, wouldn't it be amazing if we had a whole lot of people from diverse areas that actually touch something in the electorate, who feel suddenly re-energized about politics? The problem is these people tend not to get voted in because they are seen to be so niche that if you are, for example, a lesbian, or if you're trans, or if you're this or if you're that, somehow voters seem to think you'll only care about those issues. And that's completely not true, because it's the mirror test in psychology. When you look in the mirror, do you only see a woman, or only see white, or only see trans? No, we have all of those identities running at once. That said, I think it's going to take a while for voters to feel comfortable that someone who doesn't necessarily look like them or talk like them actually can still care about their interests as well as other interests that haven't been addressed by the mainstream politicians thus far.
I've been in Australia 15 years. I came from New Zealand, and I was struck immediately when I moved here the lack of Indigenous culture in everyday life. In the New Zealand Parliament, I think there are 5 Maori seats. There have been, well, there were 4 for decades. New Zealand went and got a very mixed up proportional representation voting system that completely mixed up what Parliament consists of. In Australia, it doesn't happen that way.
Oh, something extraordinary when you go to New Zealand, flick on the television. You know, who do you see in advertisements? And you see Maori people there, whereas we have this invisibility here. People from overseas will come in, and that will be something they'll say straight away, is where is your Indigenous culture? Because on one hand, which is, I think, quite a bit of a travesty, Australia likes to use that in marketing strategies. Mm. We like to pitch that we have this rich and diverse culture because we have to distinguish ourselves from Europe, where people go there and, you know, don't have to National Trust a toilet because there is a lot of culture there in terms of old buildings, etc. We have to preserve toilets because we don't have anything that's older than 150 or 200 years old. Yet we sell this indigeneity as though this is part of our rich tapestry of culture, but yet you get here and that's actually largely invisible from a lot of things that you'd consider to be our public sphere.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Lauren, over the weekend there was some news items about a report that was released that talked about a pay gap based on sexuality. And the headlines were straight men earn more than gay men, but lesbians earn more in the women's field. There was a comment, and I don't know where it came from, that was based on a perception that lesbians won't involve a parental leave cost, or multiple parental leave costs if you have more than one child. Do you have any thoughts about that sort of outcome from that research?
Yeah, I mean, that's completely unsurprising. There's been trends in Australia for a while. I certainly worked in an employer that had a policy to hire women under 25 or women over menopausal age, the argument being that was the safe zone where you didn't have to pay maternity leave.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and that's, again, not that long ago. So that highlights that, yes, this is not a surprising factor, that assumptions are made when you hire someone. So it's the same, that idea that people carry into when they're recruiting people people that they carry some stereotypes that are based on gender and sexuality are unsurprising. I like the fact that it highlights that gay men don't earn the same as straight men, because it answers that cultural misconception about the pink dollar, and that gay men have it so fantastically well because they don't have kids and that they're out there living this extravagant lifestyle. And because this is what the media sells us. This sells us this sort of slick Hollywood gay man lifestyle, which in fact, poverty is actually an issue for a whole lot of people that are straight as well as gay. And we often don't talk about this as a culture. So I think I like the fact that we're acknowledging, hey, not every gay man is working in an advertising industry and earning X amount of dollars. But in fact, hey, there's a whole lot that are also struggling. So I like that about the study. It also highlights some issues about recruitment and hiring and how we've got some biases. Now, that also, sexuality is part of that, and also race is part of this as well, where people hire people who are like them. And this comes up in study after study, where most people don't think of themselves as racist, and most people don't think of themselves as sexist or any kind of ist. And yet when they look at their friends, they tend to have friends who are like them, and they tend to look at a future hire and think, well, that person shares my values. And it's much the same we were just talking before about voting. We also vote for people who are like us. So it's not surprising that you're going to see why we still see, despite legislation, despite all these changes that we've had in our culture, that there are still these entrenched stereotypes and limitations on people who are considered to be outside of the mainstream.
These are big, big issues that you're sort of bundling into unconscious bias.
Yeah.
And although I think a lot of it might be conscious as well, especially in recruitment.
Absolutely, yeah.
But these are large things for people to have as an unconscious bias, unrecognised
And behavior. Something that legislation can't fix.
That's right.
Which is really tricky, because we love the fact that we've got all this stuff on the book. So formally, if you feel you've been, and if there is a case, great, you can take it to the courts. But in most of these cases, no one thinks they've done anything wrong. They would literally pass the lie detector test because they're not doing anything other than living how they've lived all their lives, which is they still see themselves, and they are still a good person. It's just that they're defaulting to that idea of not thinking outside of a paradigm or outside of a model that is how they've always lived, which is working with people like me who have a similar Anglo-sounding name like I have, which is like the studies that show if you have an easy to pronounce name, you will be more successful in the workforce.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.